Okay, today is May 15th, 2001, and I'm here with Mildred Mahoney, and she's going to be telling me about her experiences and memories of Pine Mountain. Okay, Emily, when did you first come to Pine Mountain Settlement School?
I came in the fall of 1953 to teach here, and that was my first trip here. I hadn't come to look the place over before I came.
Okay. How did you first hear about Pine Mountain?
A friend of mine who taught at the lab school in Chicago where I was working as a junior teacher had visited Pine Mountain when he was working at a work camp in Leslie County a few years before that time. That was the time when this was a boarding high school, but he knew that there were some teachers who stayed here and taught in one-room schools in the area, and he thought that I would be interested. So I was interested, and I wrote to Burton Rogers and applied. This was in 1950, and I was accepted, but a lot of conflicts came up. Among them was I was working on my master's, and I wasn't going to graduate until the 1st of September, and school was starting in Kentucky in the first week in August. Also about that time, I was offered a job as a full teacher at the lab school in Chicago for the coming year. And I wasn't really sure that I was going to be able to finish my master's that summer. So all in all, it seemed better to stay in Chicago at that time. And then after that year, that second year in Chicago, I went to Europe with the American Friends Service Committee in the work camp movement in the office at the Paris Center, and was there for 2 years. And when my time was approaching an end there, I didn't want to leave Europe early in order to get home in time to look for a job. So I wrote again to Pine Mountain and thought, as I did, that this was sort of a slim chance because I'd been appointed once and then hadn't taken the job. But I didn't realize then how scarce teachers were in Kentucky at that time. And Burton Rogers replied immediately that he was very interested in having me come. And so it all worked out very quickly. And I came back to the States, back to my parents' home in Indiana early in August, and came down here, I think, about the middle of August that year. And school started maybe a week or so after I got here.
Oh, okay. And what masters were you working on?
Actually, it would be simpler to say a master's in education, but in at the University of Chicago, this is in the School of Social Science, so I have a master's in social science.
Okay.
With a, I always forget this. I have a master's in social science with a minor, not a minor.
A concentration.
A concentration in education and a specialty in elementary education.
Oh, very specialized.
Just a lot of words for one course.
And so before you came, you had not seen Pine Mountain Settlement School?
No.
Okay. And was that, do you remember what some of your initial thoughts were as you, I assume you drove in and
yes,
and about the campus and the area at first?
A friend drove me down from Indiana, and it was very much as I had anticipated, although I had never been in the Kentucky mountains before. The campus was very welcoming. People were very friendly. It was obvious from the community and from what I could find out about the school situation and my specific, the room I was to teach in and so on, it was obvious that there was a lot of work to be done. So it was something that you could kind of jump in right away and get involved, and it remained that way. There was always much more to do than I could ever get done.
Okay. And where did you live at first?
I lived in Laurel House. First.
And at that time, was that the present Laurel House?
Or? Yeah, it was the present Laurel House, and the single teachers and office workers, the ladies, lived downstairs in the Laurel House.
Okay.
And the Miss Harriet Turner was the dietitian. She lived in the apartment.
Okay. And was it, as far as the curriculum went at that time, what did you teach certain things mostly, or did you spread it around a little bit?
The first year I was here, I taught second and third grade in Burkham Building, which is the building which is burned now. And the curriculum was, I would say, standard Kentucky Elementary for that time. But we did have a lot of freedom to do whatever we wanted to, or whatever we could do. We weren't closely supervised at all, that is from the county. Gurney Campbell was the principal, and he was new that year, and his wife Cora Campbell, who was a fifth and sixth grade teacher, was also new here. And they were very excellent school people who had just gotten their master's degrees from Eastern that summer. So that I didn't have close supervision, but I had every kind of help that they could give. But they were also teaching, and we were all sort of up to our necks in trying to do as much as we could. We had large groups still at that time. The first week or so, there were 48 students in my room. And then they sent, I think, eight of them upstairs to Miss Kennard's room. So I had somewhere in the high 30s or up to 40 students that year.
Okay.
That was a pretty hard job.
I can imagine. And the principal's name,
Gurney Campbell.
Okay. And he was separate from Burton Rogers?
Yes, Burton Rogers was director of Pine Mountain Settlement School.
So there was a director and a principal.
Right, and the principal also was seventh and eighth grade teacher, so he was very busy.
Okay, and then did you teach other grades throughout?
Yes, after that first year, I taught the primary room, which was usually first grade and maybe half of second grade. I did that until the early 1960s, when we'd started first, all the time I was teaching first grade, I was aware that some children came to school just completely unprepared for any kind of school experience. Some literally who hadn't ever had a pencil or a crayon. And they obviously weren't ready to start a normal first grade curriculum. So I was interested in doing something to help them be more ready for school. And for a couple of years, I think, the week before school started, I should back up. Before I came, the lady who had been teaching first grade always had one day in the spring when youngsters who were going to come to school the next year could visit to find what school was like. And I continued that, of course. And then I started for a couple of years, the week before school started, I drove the panel school bus out in the community and picked up students who were going to be in first grade. So we had just a week of kindergarten before school started.
I see.
And then we started one summer project, which we called Little School, for the 4 and 5 year olds, which was a very excellent and successful readiness experience. And we had four staff members who taught the various departments. Mary Rogers had storytelling in the library, and Jerry Workman had art, and Charlie Whitaker had phys ed, and I had reading readiness, and we changed the groups. And we were able to have a really quite exciting curriculum with that. And the older kids from the neighborhood came in to help as volunteers to help take care of the kids and participate in their games and their work and so on. And that was really quite an exciting experience. And after the second summer of that little school, then we started kindergarten year-round, and I moved from the primary building, which is now the plant center, over to the basement of Laurel House, and had kindergarten in what's now the AV room there.
Okay.
I had year-round kindergarten for 2 years. At the end of that time, the nation had come to the time of Head Start.
That's what I was just going to ask you about, because I saw in an interview recently with, I believe it was Afton Garrison, who mentioned that Head Start was modeled after Little School at Pine Mountain, or something along those
lines.
Yes,
that's maybe claiming a little bit too much credit, but the Head Start program in Harlan County was definitely modeled after our school. When nationally, a lot of people were concerned for the children needed more preparation to be ready for school.
Mm-hmm.
And when there was the national beginning of Head Start, when a certain amount of money for a certain number of units was assigned to Harlan County, then I did the orientation of the teachers for the Head Start units, and we had in-service meetings and so on. So locally, Head Start was very much patterned after our little school, and I also did with the state some in-service meetings for training teachers for Head Start. There were a lot of other people working on this same idea, and nationally there were a lot of people who contributed ideas for Head Start.
And at this point, this was still in the 50s?
This was in the 60s by this time.
Okay.
It was after the death of President Kennedy, and it was Lady Bird Johnson who really led off on the first Head Start.
Okay. I guess that was quite a challenge, as you mentioned before, some of the children, so, as you said, unprepared. And
It was quite a challenge, but it was a much easier way to work with them, a much more delightful way to work with them than when we were trying to start them off in formal first grade without preparation.
Mm.
And we had really quite an innovative curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
The closest thing I had to model, I had never been trained as a kindergarten teacher,
mm-hmm.
but my closest model was the kindergarten at the Laboratory School at the University of Chicago, where I had seen what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So we had really an exciting program.
Okay.
And smaller groups than I had had in the classroom, so that it was possible to give them a lot more individual attention and to have a lot more creative work.
Okay. And back to Burton Rogers and the principal, I was curious as to how they worked together at that time and how things were organized.
Burton was, of course, responsible for all the maintenance of the campus and the maintenance staff, for example, and the farm program. The school principal had no responsibility for this. Burton was also responsible for cooperating with the school principal on some things which were extras that an ordinary Harlan County school wasn't having at that time. And one of the big items on that list were the hot lunch program, which was in Laurel House, and the dietitian was in charge of it. Although there were hot lunch programs in other schools, but the facilities here were so much better, and the trained dietitian, Miss Turner, was really an expert at doing what could be done with what she had to work with. Burton was also responsible for raising money for the Pine Mountain part of the operation. And although teacher salaries were paid by the county, and the county paid some rent for the use of the school building, but Pine Mountain provided some extras too, as they could. They gave us some extra supplies and gave housing for the staff here on campus at reduced costs and so on. So Burton was responsible not only for those physical arrangements, but for raising what money needed to be raised for but the Pine Mountain share
I
of the
see.
expense of this. Burton also took sort of I would say, an interested role in the school. He always came to the school staff meetings, for example, and contributed what he could by way of ideas and cooperation and so on. But the principal was really in charge of the school program and the attendance reports and so on.
I see. Yes, and where did the principal live at that time?
In Jubilee House.
And that is the current across from the intern
That's
house.
right.
Okay. I always get Jubilee and Country Cottage mixed. And Burton Rogers lived in the old firehouse or
No, Burton Rogers and Mary lived in Big Log.
Oh, in Big Log. Okay. And that was interesting to hear that there was a dietitian, a full-time dietitian. That sounds almost cutting edge for considering what food is like in some schools these days.
That's true. And of course, the dietitian worked full time, not just with the planning of the meals and so on, but she worked right in the kitchen and supervised not only the preparation of hot lunch. There were three meals a day in Laurel House then, because those of us who lived in Laurel House didn't have cooking facilities. And she was responsible for the housekeeping on the rest of the campus, the buildings which were used by Pine Mountain,
I see.
just as Lorraine is now. West Wind was a hospital at that time.
Oh, still at that.
Yeah.
What time, and what year did the hospital close down?
Sorry.
Approximately.
Approximately in the early 60s, and it wasn't a clear-cut close. The hospital, well, the hospital was discontinued, But for a while we had a doctor who continued clinic service. And then we had not a full-time doctor, but a doctor who would come for about 3 months at a time for a while.
And did, was the hospital, was it somewhat separate from the school, even though it was on school grounds? It was, for instance, the way most hospitals operate that serve the public?
It wasn't separate from the school at all, although the doctor and the nurses, of course, carried out the organization of their services, but they were very much a part of the Pine Mountain staff, just as the teachers were. The teachers were paid by the county.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor and the nurses were paid by Pine Mountain. And in the end, this was one of the big problems and one of the reasons the hospital had to close, because it was not economically feasible. It cost much more than they were able to collect in fees.
I see.
And at that same time, the new hospital was built at Harlan, which was originally United Mine Workers Hospital.
Okay.
And the road had been improved by that time so that there was a good medical service available not too many miles away.
Okay. I would have thought that would be somewhat distracting sometimes. Maybe it wasn't a big deal, but if there were, you know, ambulances coming in, did that sort of thing happen
No.
during the day?
I don't recall an ambulance ever coming into the hospital. That was before we had the fire department or the EMT service
in
the community. I think that people who needed to come to the hospital by that time usually came by car.
I see.
There were still people who walked in for treatment, but if someone were seriously ill, of course, they came by car.
And
a lot of families had cars at that
mm-hmm.
time. It wasn't unusual. There were just a few families that didn't. But several of our workers walked in from their homes in the community.
Yeah, right. Okay. And tell me a little bit about more about Burton Rogers as far as his personality went and his lifestyle here and how he got involved maybe with more extracurricular things and Mary Rogers.
Yes, it's almost impossible to talk about Burton without saying Burton and Mary, although they were unique individuals and had quite different functions and personality types. Burton was very much as he is now, although he was much younger, of course, and although he was having problems with arthritis from the time that I first knew him, but it wasn't nearly as severe as it is now, of course. But his personality was very much as it is now. He was always very slow and deliberate and kind and very, very articulate. Although he spoke slowly and as if he had thought of it for a long time, he had and still has a wonderful command of vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And he had and still has this wonderful sensitivity to people. Bill Leach, who was grandson of the Creeches in the community and is now has been on our board of trustees for many years,
mm-hmm.
said a few years ago when he was talking about the problems of outsiders coming into the community, he said, "Of course, people have forgotten that Burton and Mary Rogers weren't born on Isaac's Creek."
Mm-hmm.
And this is was a very interesting situation. There were these two very, very well-educated people who were quite at home when college presidents came to campus, for example, visiting, and people from Washington came visiting and so on. And they were quite at home talking with them, answering their questions, explaining, but they were also very, very much at home in the community and with people who lived here. So, there were, of course, many sides to everyone's personality. And I was just laughing because I remembered something that Ruby Lanier, who was bookkeeper at the time I came here, said to me. She said, and I will not use any names here, but the year before I came, I think, or maybe 2 years before I came, there was an incident when a local young man who drove a school bus drove in his school bus one morning, and two eighth grade girls stayed on the bus, and they went off and spent the day together. It soon, from the reports from other children, the authorities soon knew what had happened. And Ruby Lanier said to me when she was telling me about this, she said, "Mr. Rogers was always so slow and deliberate, but it didn't take him a minute. It didn't even take him a half a minute to fire that bus driver when he drove back in the afternoon."
That's a good story.
So Mr. Rogers was quite capable of whatever action was needed, but he was always this very deliberate and understanding and kind person, even as administrator.
I do need to pause to flip the tape.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit more about some things I learned from people on the staff and in the community.
Sure.
But from the time I came here, I was intrigued and very much interested with what I heard about the beginnings of Pine Mountain Settlement School and the history and the people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky that at the time I came here, there were maybe six or seven of Uncle William and Aunt Sal's children still living.
Mm.
And two of them who lived in the quite immediate community I knew quite well.
Oh.
Columbus Creech, his youngest son, I believe, and his wife Emily Hill Creech lived closest to campus. And Henry Creech, who was not his oldest, but one of the older sons, and his wife Delia lived just a little bit farther up Isaac's Creek. And they were all very excellent sources of information about things that had happened at the school in the past, and school history, and some things even before the school had started. And then our maintenance superintendent, when I came here and for several years, was Britt Wilder, who was a grandson of Uncle William Creech. And Britt had been the four-year-old in the first school project the first summer in 1913, when they had youngsters from 4 years old to 14 years old in a kind of, well, actually it was a kindergarten. Britt was a wonderful person, both a very competent workman and a very excellent supervisor of the maintenance staff, but also a wonderful friend and a wonderful storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked to talk about the early days of the school. And
mm-hmm.
There were some funny stories about him. I think as the four-year-old, he was kind of the pet, probably,
mm-hmm.
in the first summer school. And he evidently marched in one day. The discipline, if a child was unruly, he was isolated in a chair off in the corner, which was called the lonesome seat.
Mm-hmm.
And Britt marched in one morning and said to the teacher, "You might as well sock me over in that lonesome seat today, because I ain't aiming to hurry." And that had been sort of a byword ever since that time, I think. But Britt had the stories about most of the time in that first summer, he stayed with his grandparents because they lived closer to campus. His family lived up at the head of Isaac's Creek at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And as a four-year-old, it was too far for him to walk.
Mm-hmm.
And so he stayed with his grandparents and walked down. And when he walked past Miss Pettit's house, he was scared of her dogs. And she would come out and call off the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd say, "Now, down, Gailey, and down, you boy," Britt said. And so Britt thought that one of the dogs was named You Boy. But I found out later that the dogs were named Gailey and Boy. Then after that first summer, there was a building built up above Jubilee and Country Cottage, I believe, which was called House in the Woods. And it was a platform with a roof over it. There weren't walls. And they had school there until it was too cold to stay in there anymore. And then they would come down to Big Log and had school in the living room. Britt had stories about walking to that school also. His older sister, Sally Carnett,
mm-hmm.
Ralph's mother, and his two cousins, Oma Creech and Elsie Creech.
Mm-hmm.
And Elsie Creech was then Elsie Creech Leach, and she's the mother of Bill Leach and Paul Leach.
Okay.
People who still are to have an important part in the school. They walked to school with Britt, and they evidently liked to tease him. And as an adult, when he was telling me this, he couldn't yet figure this out, but there were still chestnut stumps around.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one along up on the bank that they passed, and the girls somehow managed, he thinks they must have had the chestnuts stored somewhere, and there was a knot hole, and they could make chestnuts come out through that knot hole, and he could never figure out how it was done, and they told him only girls could do it, boys couldn't do it. And as an adult, when he was telling this, he still didn't know quite how they managed that.
Yeah, that's funny.
Then other people in the community, of course, remembered from the beginning of the school still at that time. And
for instance, the Creech sons, perhaps?
Yeah, the Creech sons, and also I remember Matt Boggs' mother talking to me about the Miss Pettit and Miss DeLong. And she said, "Miss Pettit was a wonderful person, but I love Miss DeLong." Miss DeLong. And that was pretty much the reputation, which I think Miss Pettit probably delighted in this. She was thought to have been a much sterner person.
Mm-hmm.
And Miss DeLong, who was later Mrs. Zondi, was thought to be a kinder and gentler person. I think Miss Pettit deliberately played that role.
I think I heard someone else say, actually, in a videotaped interview, I forget who it was, but they described a scenario in which when the kids would be eating at in Laurel House, if you weren't sitting up straight, and if your back was touching the back of a chair, Miss Pettit would walk by and give you a little little tap in the back and tell you to sit up straight.
There's another story about Miss Pettit, which I'll tell it as delicately as I can. She supervised the farm, and of course that meant that from the very beginning they had to almost clear, although the land had been cleared, but in terms of getting ready for building here and so on. The work that she supervised was done right, and there were men who were hired from the community to help, although the youngsters always helped, but with the construction things, of course, they had to have men hired. All right. It was necessary for them to fence grounds that were going to be used for garden or for crops, because there was no stock law at that point in Kentucky, that stock had to be confined. I mean, people's pigs and cows and so on could roam. Well, all right. Miss Pettit supervised the setting of the posts, the fence posts for the fence. She was a rather hefty woman, always described. And when the men had set the fence post, she bumped it with her rear to see whether it was set solid. And if it wasn't set solid, it had to be done over again.
That's funny. What were from your acquaintances with the Creech sons, what things did you find out from them about their father and mother, William and Sally Creech?
The sons were almost like other people in the neighborhood. They spoke of their father, although with affection, but with a certain amount of reverence. I mean, it wasn't, I'm sure they had an intimate relationship with him too, but they told of the things he did almost as a public figure in that. The mother, I think there was a much more sentimental relationship. Both of those sons were always very wholeheartedly behind their parents' project of giving the land for the school, and both of them had been very interested and had contributed a lot of things to the building of the school and the starting of the school and the planning of the program. I think that some other of the Creech children, for many reasons, weren't as closely involved in the school as Henry and Columbus were.
Okay.
They're closely involved.
Did they ever, did they describe much about, tell you any stories about growing up in the cabin that is now on campus here?
A few, I guess. Mr. Henry said once that when he was a child, a young child, the only thing they bought in the family was salt, and everything else they made or acquired from the community, the only thing they bought was salt. I once asked Mr. Henry about the large family living in that small cabin, and his answer was, well, in the summer, mother had her loom out on the porch, but which still doesn't say what they did in the winter when it was in the house. But I think as they grew up, they were fairly conscious that their father was a leader in the community, and he was a very respected person, and the neighbors came to him for help, from pulling teeth to setting bones to everything else. And I don't think that they had as intimate a relationship with him, except as other people in the community did too. But their mother was someone that they revered very much.
And jumping ahead a ways, since you had first-hand experience with this, first of all, what were, as you were teaching at Pine Mountain until 1971,
That's
correct?
right.
Okay. And what were, can you tell me anything about what changes you saw or what things were starting to happen that may have been precursors or leading up to the eventual changeover to the environmental program? And I'll ask you about that in a minute too.
Well, from everything that was happening in the world at that time was coming into this valley too. The first summer that I was here, I went home to Indiana and worked in a Girl Scout camp. And when I came back by bus to Harlan, I was told that I wouldn't believe the road from 421 up to Pine Mountain. And it had been built in what is now its present location, although it was still graveled then. But I don't know whether you've noticed how the old road in some places goes up the hill and around and up and down. But I was astonished at this long strip of straight road down in the valley coming up. So from that very first summer, there was a much better road into Pine Mountain than there had been before. A bit later than that, by the time that I was ready to leave Pine Mountain, and a few years before that, television had come to a good many homes. And literally, from my students, everybody had access to TV somewhere. It wasn't in every home, but the kids who didn't have TV at home would go someplace at the neighbors to watch TV sometimes. And that too was brought tremendous changes into the community. Employment was a problem all the time that I was here, and to a certain extent it still is. People who had jobs in the mines had a good job so far as income, but there were long layoffs in the mines, and there were also layoffs for strikes if you worked in the mines. So that people who worked in the mines had a good job while they were working, but their work was by no means that steady. There wasn't that much logging going on by the time I came here. It had been pretty well logged over, and well, we are just now back at the stage when they can really harvest timber again after that many years. It used to be, there was at one time about a third of the parents of children in our school worked in mines, and about a third worked in log woods or some other trucking or something like that, and about a third were unemployed, and a large portion of that third were on some kind of relief, which might be a permanent kind, like an old age pension or something like that. Along with improved roads, of course, there was a great improvement in automobiles in that time and transportation. During that period, partly as a result of the community council development, which was developed kind of unofficially under the umbrella of Pine Mountain, the telephones were acquired in the community. And it had the very startling thing. The company said that they didn't have enough black telephones, but also colored telephones were more expensive, and They said they didn't have any more black ones, so. But in some of the more primitive homes, here was a red telephone, and in other homes, a white telephone, which was, there were a lot of changes in the community and in the world in those years.
Okay, and then you became a board member in...
Yes, when the school was consolidated and our youngsters were transported to Green Hills, I went back to Indiana. It happened to coincide, we had been told a year before that time that my parents shouldn't be living alone together, that they were capable of taking care of themselves when both were well, but that when one was ill, the other wasn't capable of being responsible. So I went back to Indiana and lived with my parents. I think I deliberately didn't come back the first year, feeling that it was better not to be intruding for people who were teaching the class that I had taught and so on. But then when I came back 2 years in the spring, after I'd been away 2 years.
Which would have been
1973, I suppose. Okay. Alvin Boggs, who was by that time had succeeded Burton Rogers as director, asked me if I would be interested in coming onto the board. And I said that I would be interested, and so it was, I think it was the fall meeting of the board before I was, and that spring meeting I was elected the board, which meant that my first meeting was in the fall.
So that was after the changeover to the environmentalism?
Yes, right.
Okay.
The changeover to environmental education was supposed to come exactly when I left. That is, the school closed in the spring and was to open in the new school at Green Hills in the fall. But in August, they got word that the new school wasn't going to be ready. So not only the students who had come to Pine Mountain before, but the students who'd gone to Green Hills before were transported here until the middle of January of that year.
Okay.
So I didn't quite coincide with the closing of the school at Pine Mountain. I thought that I had when I left in the spring, but then there was school at Pine Mountain until the middle of January, until the new school was ready.
And were you aware or how aware were you of talks or ideas about what was going to be happening as far as becoming the environmental education?
Let me back up a little bit. All the time that I was here and Burton was director, there were weekly staff meetings of the school teachers and the other personnel that worked here on the maintenance and the kitchen and the hospital and the clinic and so on. And everything was done in a very much in a cooperative manner. All the ideas, all the problems were brought before the entire group, and there was free discussion. And the director, of course, had to make the decision in the end, but it was very, very much a cooperative project all the way along. And that, I think, had been the pattern. That was an innovation of Burton's. That had been the pattern before he came also. And the staff members who had been here earlier were accustomed to that method of procedure. Okay. So comes the very major time when they knew that the school was eventually going to be moved to Green Hills, and they had to consider what they wanted to do. There were a lot of different ideas floated, and the president of BREA was chairman of our board. It was Dr. Weatherford at that time. He was very much interested in having a program for high school dropouts at Pine Mountain. And there were a lot of local people who felt that Pine Mountain ought to go back to operating a boarding high school as he had before. And this wasn't practical, but it was a very strong wish from the community. There were other people who felt that they ought to go back to a stronger medical program as they had earlier, which again wasn't feasible financially, but there was that wish they would have liked that. I'm not sure. At the time I accepted this as it came, but now as I've heard other people describing it, I'm not sure that I was completely aware of what went on. But as I say, this was being discussed in staff meeting, what the possibilities were. Lauren Kramer, who was on staff at that time as a teacher, came to staff meeting one day with a magazine which was described an environmental education project. There was increasing awareness in the country at that time of the need for environmental education. It seemed to many of us that this just seemed to be the right thing for Pine Mountain, that we had so much here that would be an ideal setting for a Pine Mountain, for an environmental education program. What I've become a little bit suspicious of later, I'm not as sure that it was really Lauren Kramer's idea as I used to be. I know that Nancy Sather was heavily involved in it at that time. She was a teacher here at that time too. And I know that Mary Rogers was very enthusiastic from the beginning. So I'm not sure really who first found the magazine with the article. But this seemed to the staff almost from the time it was first presented as just the right thing for us. Now, it wasn't as easy to sell the idea to the trustees and to President Weatherford, who was the chairman of the Board of Trustees. But eventually, we succeeded in selling them the idea.
I heard the same thing from an interview with Mary Rogers. She mentioned it was a little tough as selling it to the trustees, but she did sound that she expressed her enthusiasm then about when it, and that was, must have been about 88, I think that was. Okay, well, is there anything else you'd like to? We are running out of time here.
Yes, and I think I'm running out of things to say too.
Okay. Well,
it's always a pleasure to remember about both the things that happened while I was here and things that I heard about the history. What I should say, of course, I was back in Indiana teaching for 22 years. And then after both my parents had died and I retired from teaching there, I came back here 8 years ago. And for the first 3 years after that, I worked as an aide at Green Hills School, taking care of a little boy who had spina bifida. But I also did some volunteer tasks around here, and I've lived in West Wind all this time. And then at the end of those 3 years, when the little boy was getting too heavy for me to lift, retired from that position and was going to be a full-time volunteer here working mainly in the library. But unfortunately, this coincided with the time that Paul Hayes developed lung cancer. So for the latter period of his illness and then after his death, I worked in the office mostly until we hired Robin Lambert. When I went back to being full-time volunteer, continuing to do some office work and also library work.
Oh, I did want to ask you about brief, and as well, you've been the primary coordinator or director of the intervention program. I did want to ask, and I'm glad you brought that up, what it was, what, for how long you were the interim director of Pine Mountain.
Paul Hayes died at the beginning of October, and Robin moved here at the beginning of August, the fall, so it was less than a year. And actually, we were aware that Paul was not at all well, but we were only aware of the diagnosis for about from the beginning of August of the last year of his life. So it was really just about a year.
Oh, okay. I see. And
But I want to say something about intervention to someone that we
yes.
haven't mentioned. The director who followed Alvin Boggs was Jim Urquhart, and his wife Carol, who was program director at that time, followed up on the idea which President Weatherford had favored in the beginning, which was that we try to tackle the dropout program. But she followed up at the level of trying to help students with their basic education, being aware of that, and organized actually, or got a grant for the first intervention program. It didn't succeed too well. The idea went well, but they barely had it off the ground. Well, what they were doing was having kids come in after school. Okay. Because of other problems with the staff at that time, this program, it was a good idea, and they got the organization going, but never had that many children actually participating regularly. Then when Paul and Ellen Hayes took over, Ellen, who had been a teacher, was extremely interested in the intervention program and got it started in its present form, which is having a retired teacher who works as a volunteer for a certain number of hours a week in a
Nice.
public school.
Okay.
Okay. And I came in when Paul was no longer able. After Ellen's death, Paul carried this on.
And that was in
And,
96 or
yes.
okay.
And then Paul's death was in 96, yes.
Okay.
Okay. Are
Okay,
we running
well,
out of time?
yes, I'm sorry we don't have more time, but thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
For
We're off the tape, I
very
trust, by now.
informative interview.